Potter is away this week. I'm Susan Lewis.
And I'm Eric Brannon.
On this week's show, we bring you 2010 in review.
We look back at the past year in the arts in our region and bring you the highlights of the news, issues, and events, and the people who made them happen.
We've witnessed memorable performances and exhibitions and rediscovered many great perennial treasures.
It's also been a year of change and surprises. All ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
As the new year got underway, four-time Tony Award winner Terrence McNally premiered his newest play, Golden Age, at the Philadelphia Theater Company. The work, set backstage during the premiere of Bellini's Il Puritano, was McNally's third play about opera.
I was very interested in the relationship between the creator, the composer, and his interpreters, because the music is just notes on a page, and it's the singers who give them life. Also, it's a backstage story, the stress and strain of an opening night.
Also in January, Philadelphia kicked off a new international arts festival, celebrating the role of print in contemporary art and highlighting the city's history as a printmaking epicenter. Philographica involved more than 300 artists and 80 venues. The festival's artistic director, Jose Roca, wanted to reach beyond the obvious art forums.
People ask me, how come you have 80 different partners? And I say, it can be an archive, it can be the historical society, it can be the philosophical society. So it's a question of not limiting yourself to the usual suspects.
Interpreting the work of composers from different cultures and eras, the Philadelphia string trio, Time for Three, released its album, Three Fervent Travelers. Time for Three violinist Zach Depew, an alum of the Philadelphia Orchestra and now concertmaster of the Indianapolis Symphony, explained the group's love of musical exploration.
We're three college buddies that are creating music together in a manner that is just because it feels good. If a Brazilian jam tune catches us, we're going to want to create around that. I've always genuinely felt it's been from an organic process for us and not to prove a point ever.
In February, the Philadelphia Museum of Art opened the exhibition Picasso in the Avant-Garde in Paris. Curator of modern art Michael Taylor said the 20th century Spanish artist defied the artistic conventions of the time.
Painting up until this point had been too traditional, too rule-bound, the sort of the ideas of perspective, and this is all the things he was getting rid of.
We also took a look at an exhibition at the Pennsylvania Historical Society that examined an unusual chapter in the history of a small piece of land in the Delaware River. Petty's Island was for a time inhabited by 19th century Irish immigrant Ralston Laird, who raised a family there and proclaimed himself king of the island. The period was documented by artist Duke Riley, who's found that urban waterfronts yield the most interesting stories.
Usually that's sort of where the history of the city begins, because the waterfront played a significant role in why they set the city up there for, you know, whatever it may be. You know, up until recently, those were less desirable places, though, to live in the city, and those areas were the periphery of urban society and took on more of a lawless dimension to them.
While Duke Riley was doing his research in the east of the city, artist Stephen Powers was in West Philadelphia writing a new kind of local history. His Love Letters is a series of over 50 murals viewable from the Market Street elevated train. A native of the neighborhood, Powers wanted to make sure his work was in tune with his audience.
I was genuinely interested in creating work that the neighborhood took ownership of, and they have, because it does reflect a lot of what West Philly brought to me in the way of their concerns and the things that they were interested in and the phrases that were interesting to them and they thought reflected their worldview.
Also in February, another Philadelphia native, jazz legend Jimmy Heath, released his autobiography, I Walked with Giants. Heath writes about performing with John Coltrane, Miles Davis, and other jazz icons. Comparisons with the great Charlie Bird Parker, Heath was called Little Bird, led him to switch from alto to tenor sax.
It was very difficult to have your own identity at that time on the alto saxophone. He was such a dominant personality, and his musicality was superb. So I decided to change to tenor But what happens is you still play some Charlie Parker when you're on the tenor, but it gives you a little bit of individuality.
As March blew in, we spoke with another member of the jazz elite, pianist and composer Bill Cunliffe, who had just won his first Grammy for Best Instrumental Arrangement for West Side Story. Despite a changing music industry and an uncertain economy, Cunliffe believes a musician or composer who adapts will get by.
He'll do just fine. He'll probably be a little more multimedia and bifurcated and diverse. He'll be playing, he'll be promoting his own concerts, he'll be composing, he'll probably be teaching a little bit. He'll do okay. Music isn't going to go away.
Later in the year, Cunliffe was nominated for a 2010 Grammy for his composition Fourth Stream La Banda, a work commissioned and premiered by Temple University Symphony Orchestra. Also in March, we spoke with Christopher Makatsouras, the Academy of Vocal Arts music director, an educator who has been cultivating young operatic talent for 33 years. He acknowledges that singing opera takes a certain amount of bravado.
I like it when I see young people with a little bit of arrogance in them. I like that. I like people to come up and say, well, what do you mean by this? But after a while, you get a little bit tired of that. And you say, no, this is the law. Just do it.
From jazz to opera to classical music. In March, we also spoke to one of today's most exciting young conductors, who was then in the running for the music director spot of the Philadelphia Orchestra. In a break from previous visits, Vladimir Yurovsky, on this occasion, guest conducted standard repertoire.
I find it very important to get onto the field of classical music, which is always the most difficult, and it is also probably the best proof of a good relationship between a conductor and an orchestra if they get along in classical pieces. Because it's much easier to get along in pieces the orchestra doesn't know.
2010 was the 200th anniversary of the birth of celebrated pianist and composer Frédéric Chopin. And as Pennsylvania Ballet presented a program set to his works, we considered why his music, seen as demanding for most pianists, works so well with dance. Pennsylvania Ballet's artistic director, Roy Kaiser, suggested the composer's logical progressions appeal to choreographers in an art form that, like Chopin's music, makes highly skilled movements appear effortless.
While the technique is not always the most natural thing that the human body has been asked to do, movement is very, very natural. And I find that a lot of Chopin's music is very natural. It feels like it comes and sounds like it comes from a very natural, organic place.
A few blocks south on Broad Street, the Philadelphia Theater Company was premiering Red Hot Patriot, a one-woman show with stage and screen star Kathleen Turner playing the late political columnist Molly Ivins. Turner said Ivins used humor to get people thinking about serious things like civic responsibility.
Jokes are very important to her, but that's not just because she enjoys them. It's because they're a means to an end that she believes that if you make somebody laugh, they open up their ears and they hear you.
In April, the Philadelphia Orchestra was heard by Fresh Ears on its three-week tour of Asia, making stops in Korea, Japan, and China. Concertmaster David Kim said even in places where the orchestra was making its first visit, audiences still knew the Philadelphia sound.
And I think it's really important for us, the orchestra, to appear all over the world, to continue to play. It's great for us. We appear in different halls before tremendously enthusiastic audiences. It's a great morale booster for us. We consider it a great privilege and an important part of the job to represent the city and the Commonwealth all over the world.
The tour had its share of surprises. When pianist Martha Argerich had to cancel her performance with the orchestra in Tokyo, the hot-tempered Ivo Pogorelich filled in. Veteran Philadelphia Orchestra violinist Herb Light told us of an unusual rehearsal.
He was wearing a white ski hat with a bright red scarf. I actually thought it was Santa Claus coming a little early. But he stomped in, and from that time on, it was electric.
On tour, many musicians kept busy on stage and off, sightseeing, connecting with old friends, conducting master classes, and performing chamber music at receptions. During the last leg in China, cellist Ulrich Buchhaler brushed up on his Chinese and met the language teachers he'd been studying with online.
What does that mean?
My Chinese is getting more and more fluent.
A few orchestra members visited the village of Dujiangyan in China's Sichuan province, a region still recovering from a 2008 earthquake. Violinist Phil Cates had also been there 2 years before.
Just the delight on the children's faces, you know, that were legs in casts, missing limbs, you know, all kinds of things, you know, just to see them respond when they otherwise, you know, when you walk into the room, they're just lying there kind of really not caring.
The same month that Asia was getting a taste of Philadelphia, Philadelphians were enjoying a gift given by an Eastern nation long ago. Each April, the Cherry Blossom Festival takes place in Fairmount Park, where 1,600 trees, given to the city by Japan in 1926, come into bloom. Aaron Delaplane, assistant director of the Japan-American Society of Greater Philadelphia, described the flower's great significance in Japanese culture.
The cherry blossom really was adopted by the samurai class during the feudal ages as a symbol of the brevity of life and the passing beauty, and it really captured the imagination of the people of Japan.
While cherry blossoms provide an appealing sight, an exhibition at Longwood Gardens explored smells and fragrance, which display designer Jim Sutton said is not necessarily tied to beauty.
Sometimes the ones that have the most powerful scents have the most subtle flowers, and sometimes they have just a really bad form. We've looked really hard to find a frankincense tree and a myrrh tree because they're so steeped in history, but they're really unattractive little trees.
Also in April, Philadelphia-based composer Jennifer Higdon was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for her violin concerto commissioned for Hilary Hahn. It just so happened that Higdon got word of the announcement while she was on the way to pick up the Grammy she had won for her percussion concerto earlier in 2010.
Yeah, it is an exceptional 24 hours. I had to go down to a Federal Express warehouse and pick it up. So it was a pretty cool thing to tell the receptionist there, oh, this is my Grammy. Her eyes about popped out of her head.
In May, we spoke with up-and-coming soprano Leah Partridge, who sang Violetta in the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of La Traviata. Partridge described her ongoing quest to find her true musical voice.
I'm searching, I guess, and now at this point in my career, for that self again, that person who started singing because it was something that just kind of poured out of me, not because I was trying to create some singing perfection that maybe you would hear on a recording.
Not all recordings are about perfection, though. The Philadelphia Classical Symphony performed a violin concerto exploring the Lenape Indian experience, in which composer Morris Wright chose to include Native American field recordings made in 1928 on a primitive dictaphone.
It sounds very fragile, like it's barely there, like it may fade away, the recording. And so it was the fragileness of the document that struck me. And so it's a sense, I think, of this very beautiful document that was right on the edge of disappearing into the noise.
Also in May, we visited the German Society of Pennsylvania and spoke with its board chairman, Hardy von Anmüller, who, as it turns out, has a rather extraordinary tie with Beethoven's Ninth, and more specifically, to its final movement.
Ode to Joy has a very personal recollection on me because Friedrich Schiller composed the words to it on my grandmother's estate.
In June, the German violinist Arabella Steinbacher joined the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Kimmel Center. Although she played Mozart, she loves a wide range of music.
It's just very much fun to play the works of the 20th century, also because, yeah, very often it's just very wild. And I think I enjoy very much to put all the energy into it and just to let it go. And, I mean, with the other repertoire, for example, like Beethoven or also especially Mozart, you have to be always very delicate and you have to be careful not to put too much aggression into it, otherwise it destroys the piece.
Big news came later that month when the Philadelphia Orchestra introduced its next music director, the much-in-demand French-Canadian conductor Yannick Nézet-Séguin, who was very clear about his new role.
I think my primary responsibility as an interpreter, as a musician, is to serve the composer. But as a conductor is not only to lead, but it's a blend between leading and serving the musicians.
Nézet-Séguin expressed reverence for the legacy of his predecessors.
Of course, to be in such a line is overwhelming, and it does create a sense of responsibility about what we call the Philadelphia sound. So I think we can expect that I will mold that wonderful instrument and that sound and keep exploring with the musicians throughout all of the repertoire.
Also in June, we spoke to pianist Haoshen Zhang, who, while a student at Curtis, won the prestigious Van Cliburn International Piano Competition. The second youngest winner in the competition's history was surprisingly unflappable.
the key to get over pressure is very ironically by just thinking about music. If under very high pressure, you still can be totally focused only on music, enjoying music, while knowing that people are judging you, and not to care about that, then you choose something great.
We also saw this kind of passion for fine art in collectors Dorothy and Herbert Vogel. The two seniors, a former postal worker and a retired librarian, had been giving away their massive collection of paintings, drawings, and sculpture with gifts of 50 works for each of the 50 states. For Dorothy Vogel, art has never been about the money.
I don't think you should worry about it. Its worth. We never bought for investment because it can go up or down, but I think the important thing is that you like it.
In July, a restoration was completed on one of Philadelphia's most prized works of art, the subject of a $68 million fundraising campaign in 2006 to keep it in the city. Thomas Aiken's masterpiece, The Gross Clinic, now jointly owned by the Philadelphia Museum of Art and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, became the focus of an exhibition at the Museum of Art. Curator of American art Kathleen Foster explained that some previous conservation efforts had mistakenly altered the effect the artist had intended.
Misunderstanding of the painting surface had led to the removal of Aiken's final toning glazes, confusing it with dirt or just in a wish to make the picture brighter. But Aiken's had covered the painting with dark glazes in order to subdue the strong tones. What he really wanted was a painting that was this masterpiece of light and dark.
That month, we learned that another cultural treasure would be getting a sibling of sorts. Klaus Oldenburg came to town to reveal designs for a new outdoor sculpture commissioned by the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. A 53-foot-high work in the shape of a paintbrush will stand at Broad Street just a few blocks north from his iconic clothespin. Oldenburg explained that everyday objects are just the starting points for these public works.
This is an object which does become transformed by its circumstances, by its materials, and by my imagination.
Also in July, Pulitzer Prize winner Philip Levine saw some of his work transformed. The chamber choir The Crossing, led by Donald Nally, celebrated its yearly Month of Moderns festival with a premiere which used Levine's poems as the libretto.
I give the world my worn-out breath on an old tune. I give it all I have and take it back again.
July also marked the 5-year anniversary of Ballet X. Co-founder and former PA Ballet dancer Christine Cox reflected on the contemporary company's goals.
We wanted to have an outlet and create a place where dancers could have fun and choreographers could come and play on these amazing dancers that we brought together.
The company's programs have ranged from abstract to narrative, serious to comedic, showcasing work from choreographers from Philadelphia and beyond. In August, local and international performing artists gathered in Philadelphia for the 14th annual Live Arts Festival, the curated portion of the Philly Fringe. The festival as a whole provided audiences with an eclectic array of new dance, theater, and music performances. For producing director Nick Stuccio, the annual festival celebrates experimentation, which naturally leads to some performances in unconventional venues.
That's part of the sort of DNA of what we've built, which is to put work outside of formal space, outside of theater space.
Before the summer was out, iconic crooner Tony Bennett also came to town. He discovered his signature sound in the 1950s when his New York City vocal coach, Mimi Spear, told him to imitate not the other singers, but instead...
imitate musicians. Find out how they're phrasing the trombones, the saxophone, the piano players. So I liked Art Tatum because he was just the most unbelievable piano player and phrased very different. And Stan Getz had this beautiful honey sound. I put those two together, and that's how I got my own style.
Distinctive styles of visual art were represented in Going Green, a traveling exhibition of environmental art by Taiwanese artists at the Asian Arts Initiative and the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education in Roxborough. Site-specific works at the Schuylkill Center included a sculpture made from branches and the outline of a giant Buddha made from pine needles on the forest floor. Nature was also on the mind of an acclaimed Estonian composer, Erkki Svenntuur. The Baltic republics are garnering increasing attention for producing high-quality symphonic as well as choral music. For Tuur, the wilderness is the starting point for much of his music.
You are in a connection with something which is so much older and bigger than
than we are here on, mm-hmm. in this planet. And I think it plays a role. It's not that I'm painting the nature with sounds. I'm not at all. But I think that this environment helps me with a great deal to concentrate on my work and to get the energy for it.
The pioneering 20th century sculptor and furniture maker Wharton Escherick also found his muse in the great outdoors. A multi-venue, interdisciplinary exhibition on the Philadelphia Native opened in September. Wharton Escherick Museum curator Paul Eisenhower said that Escherick, most famous for his wooden curvilinear furniture, taught people to see ordinary objects as art.
Sculptors started thinking about furniture and other functional items differently, and people who made functional items started thinking about them differently as well. So it was really bridging that gap between art and craft.
While Escherick made people see differently, the New York Music Collective, Bang on a Can, aimed to make people hear differently when they staged the 10-hour music marathon at World Cafe Live in Philadelphia. Bang on a Can executive director Kenny Savelson said that the duration of the concert created the potential for a sea change in the way audiences listen.
After some hours of all this music kind of side by side, you know, just the normal way of listening seems to melt away, and the normal associations you may have for independently reviewing the experience you're having or the music, you know, kind of disappears, and you start to hear everything on a much freer, I think, you know, level.
Belgian composer and conductor Dirk Brasse began his tenure as music director of the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia this fall. Before pursuing conducting as a career, Brasse had been an orchestral trumpet player, an experience he said has given him an instrumentalist perspective.
And if there is something that musicians hate all over the world, it's a conductor coming in front of the orchestra and talking. It's all about playing.
Also in September, we spoke with author Robert Whitman, who, in a memoir, details his over 20-year-long career as an FBI agent specializing in art theft. In the 1980s, assigned to the Philadelphia Field Division, Whitman was instrumental in solving many high-profile arts and antiquities crimes, including thefts from the Rodin Museum, the Penn Museum, and the Pennsylvania Historical Society, recovering items ranging from paintings to sculpture and even
a Civil War battle flag that was carried in a battle by the 12th Regiment Corps d'Afrique, which was an African-American U.S. Army regiment. And in that battle of Port Hudson, I believe 4 to 5 people were shot out from under the flag. So it was considered to be a blood cloth. You know, what's interesting is that the value of that particular flag was about $30,000 on the open market. But, you know, the true value is not the financial, it's not the monetary. It's the cultural history and a cultural value.
This year was the 150th anniversary of the birth of a pillar of Western literature and theater. In October, the Lantern Theater staged Anton Chekhov's classic, Uncle Vanya. Lantern's associate artistic director, Casey McMillan, said a number of pop culture TV shows owe a debt to Chekhov, who elevated the concerns of everyday people.
Don't listen to anyone who tells you, oh, people sit about drinking tea, nothing happens. Well, yeah, they're sitting drinking tea while their entire lives fall apart.
Meanwhile, in Germany, conductor Yannick Nézet-Séguin reached another milestone. The Philadelphia Orchestra's music director designate spoke with us before his much-anticipated debut with the Berlin Philharmonic.
However, I am nervous because God knows I am nervous like everyone. I don't want to show up on that podium and be this little kid who's afraid of being there or is timid or whatever it is. I've never been really this way, and so I really wanted to treat this Berlin Philharmonic debut as just another day at the office. You know, of course it's not, but yeah, in many ways it is. It's just making music with great musicians.
Italian artist Michelangelo Pistoletto was in town for the opening of exhibitions at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, including one showcasing his distinctive mirror paintings. The works reflect the images of viewers, in accordance with the artist's belief in the importance of interactive art.
Finally, it's not me painting all the people that will participate to the exhibition that will be present in the show, but it is the work itself that is producing the effect.
Self-reflection is the theme of an exhibition that opened at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in October. Narcissus in the Studio explored a range of artists' self-portraits. Among them, Philadelphia artist Elizabeth Osborne represented herself with colorful vertical stripes in a rectangle standing on a table's edge, alongside another rectangle through which we can see the outline of the Ben Franklin Bridge. with which she has a direct family connection.
The view was a symbol for my father, who designed that bridge, Paul Cray. And the table below, of course, is part of the artist's studio, the table with the palette and paint on it.
Also in October, we spoke with contemporary architect Kim Wilkie, who designed the new terraced entrance plaza for Longwood Gardens Eastern Conservatory.
I hope that there'll be times when it's just one person sitting there peacefully in the evening sun, and other times when there are 1,500 people enjoying a piece of music. So it has to be very flexible. It's an entrance, but it's also a place just to rest and be on your own.
The allure of light was evident in a new exhibition at the Reading Public Museum, which showcased the artistry in Tiffany lamps. The museum's Mike Anderson said the idea behind the lamps was to bring art within the reach of the general public.
Tiffany really wanted to take it out of the museum and put it into people's homes and have them really appreciate the beauty of art and nature as well. And just, you can popularize it by mass production, but Tiffany kept it as an art because each piece was handmade.
In November, the National Museum of Jewish History opened the doors to its new building, just a block away from its former home. President and CEO Michael Rosenzweig believes the institution has a broader message.
This is really a story about freedom. It's a story about what a particular immigrant ethnic group has been able to achieve, given the blessings of freedom we enjoy in this country. And in that respect, it's a quite universal story, and it's really for all Americans.
The power of music to bridge differences was a theme of the play Old Wicked Songs at the Bristol Riverside Theater. A young American piano prodigy and an older professor in 1980s Vienna learned to connect through their work on a song cycle by Robert Schumann. For playwright John Marins, the music, set to the poetry of Heinrich Heine, was central.
I think he was only 21 years old when he wrote these angry young man poems. The beauty of it is that Schumann then arranged these songs in a way that has a real emotional build to it.
In December, the Philadelphia Shakespeare Company expanded its offerings with a series that showcased contemporary artists' approaches to the classics. Company founder Carmen Kahn said the classical cabaret was created in the spirit of the master.
Classical work is not a dead form. You have to keep refreshing it, reinventing it, without losing what makes it great. And I think if you take your cue from Shakespeare, that's what he did throughout his whole career with his writing.
Also in December, the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society presented Anonymous Four, the female vocal quartet known for its modern interpretations of medieval sacred music. Member Susan Hellenauer said the group's signature sound arises naturally out of intellectual compatibility.
The vocal blend has nothing to do with trying to make our voices sound alike. It has to do with the interpretation of the line that we're singing. So if we all agree on where the high points of the line are, where the text goes, you know, both the rhetoric and the weight of the syllables that we're singing and the musical shapes, the gestures that go with them, then we're going to sound blended.
And those were the highlights from 2010.
We hope you've enjoyed the past year in the arts, and on behalf of everyone at Creatively Speaking, including contributors David Patrick Stearns, Tom Keels, and Jane Pepper, thanks for listening.
Our executive producer is Jack Moore. Our managing editor is Jim Cotter, who will be back next show when we start another year of bringing you the best in arts and culture.
I'm Eric Brannan.
And I'm Susan Lewis. Enjoy the rest of the holidays and have a happy new year.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.